Our speaker tonight is Richard Watkins, Dick Watkins. He is a retired chemical engineer from DuPont, originally from Camden, but now lives in St. Matthews. He purchased some property on the Congaree in Calhoun County in 1987, and obviously that whetted his interest in what he's going to be sharing with us tonight about the history of the land in that area. He's a founding member of the Friends of Congaree Swamp. He's participated in citizen advocacy campaigns to establish and expand Congaree Swamp National Monument, now National Park. He's a member of the
Kowassee
Basin Focus Group, which encourages and assists landowners to voluntarily protect their property with conservation easements. The Kowassee is for Congaree, Wateree, and Upper Santee Rivers. So I'm certainly looking forward to hearing what he has to tell us tonight, and I hope y'all are too. So here's Dick.
We'll hope this is working. Good evening. I thank Margaret for inviting me to share some information with you. I thank Eric for his help with the graphics. I describe my research as land genealogy, in contrast to family genealogy. The research on land began some years after a conservationist friend and I purchased the tract of land that is highlighted on this image. It's a riverfront tract opposite Congaree National Park. That tract is known locally as Dolan Hill. And I hoped to learn some history of the Dolan Hill tract. Not surprisingly, my research encountered the same complication that probably all of us have encountered at one time or another, that being the destruction of Orangeburg District records in 1865. Eventually, I thought I might learn more about the Dolan Hill tract if I also learned about other tracts along the river. And perhaps this plat research can become addictive. I don't know. I identified more and more plats up and down the southwest side of the Congaree River and its tributaries. And then I continued down the southwest side of the Santee and its tributaries. Eventually, originally I had no intention of crossing over the Santee, but eventually I crossed over to the northeast side of the Santee and then up both sides of the Wateree. What am I not doing right here?
Turned on?
Maybe I'm not turned on. That might make a difference. Okay. With land genealogy, there are always more questions than answers, and pieces are often missing from the puzzle. This map has no title and no date. That doesn't identify the river. At the Department of Archives and History, this map is described only as plat of 2,546 acres divided among 14 individuals. So what are these lands? We'll return to this map later. We'll focus tonight on Amelia Township along the Congaree. If time allows, we'll briefly visit the Upper Santee. In the present-day landscape, the Santee River begins at the confluence of the Congaree and the Wateree Rivers. But back in the 1730s and 40s and 50s, the Santee was also the name for the river we call Congaree. We'll see plats tonight which say Santee River, but actually pertain to the Congaree River. The Congaree corridor includes extensive floodplain, most of which is north of the river. Congaree National Park, to which Margaret referred a few moments ago, is entirely north of the river. The south side of the river also has floodplain, but not as much as the north side. The south side has high bluffs, some of which are close to the river, and some are behind floodplain. In some places, these bluffs south of the river are 200 feet higher than the floodplain. Just as an example, or I'll just point out that the plantation names and place names often reflected these higher elevations. Names such as Mount Joseph and Mount Harriet. This is a view from the hilltop where Rebecca Mott's mansion stood at Mount Joseph Plantation in 1781 at the time of the American Revolution. The inset in the lower right corner there shows the DAR marker at the site. Elevation at this hilltop is about 160 feet higher than the floodplain across the river. We'll visit Mount Joseph and Mount Harriet if time allows, but let's begin with less well-known lands upriver above High Hill Creek. That's not what I was expecting. There we go. This is DeBrom's 1757 map, on which we see the Congaree River, still identified as Santee. It's the watery river flowing from the north. The red square there is the site of the town of Amelia. Here we have Saxagatha Township's lower line, just below Sandy Run. Beaver Creek, between Saxagatha and Amelia, the upper line of Amelia. And this is High Hill Creek, unidentified on DeBrom's map, but that's High Hill Creek. The unnamed little water course there, just above the Amelia line, is known today as Butler's Gut. If you remember the Dolan Hill tract on the first graphic, the mouth of Butler's Gut is at the Dolan Hill tract. This plat shows land granted to John Hamerton, who was a British government official. Hamerton's land being at this exact location that we were just talking about. The tract's southeastern property line is the upper line of Amelia Township, and most of the tract's northern boundary is the unnamed creek at which we were just looking on DeBrom's map. More than 75 years later, part of this same tract was re-granted, an 850-acre grant to Dr. V.D.V. Jameson. Those of you who have Orangeburg connections will surely recognize Dr. Jameson's name. Hamerton's tract bounded northwestward on this 250-acre tract, granted in 1735 to Joshua Lockwood. And Lockwood also received land grants in Orangeburg Township. Now, this particular tract was actually between Amelia and Saxagatha. Just a few words of explanation or disclaimer at this point. The graphics in my presentation, I hope, are oriented with north vertical. The names on the graphics are spelled or misspelled as in the source documents. And on a couple of occasions here, I will anglicize pronunciations of a couple of names that I realize should be pronounced somewhat differently. On Cook's 1773 map, Margaret and I have corresponded about the fact that James Cook seems to have erred in his depiction of Saxagatha's lower line for some reason, Cook showed Saxagoth's lower line coming in at the mouth of Beaver Creek, and that is contrary to our understandings of Saxagoth's lower line. Here again is Amelia's upper line, and High Hill Creek identified as well. Next, we'll look at four riverfront tracts in the vicinity of High Hill Creek. One of the early land grants in Amelia was this 400-acre tract granted in 1736 to John Cook. The plat, again, I'm not sure how readable these are from afar, but the plat shows High Hill Creek on the southwest part of the of this tract for John Cook. The next tract upriver was 150 acres granted, the plat 1750, the grant in 1752 to Matthew Schwab. And this creek, or this plat also shows High Hill Creek. The next tract upriver was 300 acres. 1753 plat, 1754 grant to Jacob Winter. We will see George Barsh's name tonight. In 1773, George Barsh purchased this 300-acre tract, which was granted originally to Jacob Winter. The OGSGS newsletter several years ago published Margaret's article about Barsh family genealogy. And next tract upriver was 500 acres granted in 1756 to Thomas Kennerly. I'll just mention at this point, most of you are aware that Brent Holcomb has published petitions for land for many land grants in the 1740s, 1750s, and such years. Those petitions are certainly sources of good genealogical information for your family research as well as my interest in land research.
They all seem to have the same elongated rectangular shape. Is there a reason for that?
I think the understanding was usually, or that the amount of river frontage should not exceed one-fourth the track should be four times as long as the amount of river frontage. I guess that's probably a better way of saying it. So, you know, recognizing that river frontage would have been a highly valued attribute for a tract, the government was aware that only so much river frontage, so that seemed to be the case, the length of the track being four times the amount of frontage. Kennerly's 1752 petition describes that his family has moved to South Carolina from Virginia. And in conversations with my friend Lynn Teague, I've learned that Thomas Kennerly is her ancestor. Thomas Kennerly's son, James Kennerly, sold this 500-acre tract in 1776 to John Lord, whom we'll mention again. We'll return to these same four tracts in a few minutes, but meanwhile, let's find a lost plantation. Probably many of you know Jeff Reed at the Calhoun County Museum. Jeff is a descendant of Colonel William Thompson of Belleville Plantation. William Thompson was a prominent citizen of Amelia Township and Orangeburg District and was one of the heroes when the Patriots repulsed the British attack at Sullivan's Island in June 1776. Family records in Jeff Reed's possession mention a birth and a marriage at a plantation called Mount Thompson. Two centuries have passed since those family records, and the location of Mount Thompson Plantation was no longer known. Where was Mount Thompson? Again, notice that the plantation name indicates high elevation of land on the south side of the river. This 1786 plat shows 802 acres fronting on the Congaree River and flanking both sides of High Hill Creek. This plat accompanied a 1786 mortgage when William Thompson mortgaged these 802 acres to the commissioners of the paper medium loan. Nothing on this plat and nothing in the mortgage mentions Mount Thompson Plantation. In fact, the 1786 mortgage implies these 802 acres are part of Belleville, the home plantation on which William Thompson resides. I hypothesize these 802 acres might not have been called Mount Thompson in 1786, but these 802 acres were absolutely, positively part of the plantation called Mount Thompson in the family records in 1809. Now, how can I say that this was part of Mount Thompson? As you know, as we've already mentioned, almost all public records in Orangeburg District were destroyed in 1865. But somehow, a few records survived from the Orangeburg Court of Equity, and Brent Holcomb has published those surviving records in his book titled Orangeburg District, South Carolina, Returns in Partition from the Court of Equity, 1824-1837. I'm sure Brent would be happy to sell you a copy of that book this weekend. The surviving court records include a very convoluted lawsuit in the 1820s about debts pertaining to a plantation called Mount Thompson. The name Mount Thompson appears several times in the court record, but the court record does not describe the plantation or its location. However, the court record mentions several details which enable us, without any doubt, to connect the 1820s court case to William Thompson's 1786 mortgage of these 802 acres and a related 1815 mortgage of these same 802 acres by Colonel John Johnson. The court case recites that William Thompson sold the plantation to his son-in-law, L. Nathan Haskell. And I'll mention parenthetically that it was during the years of Haskell ownership that the name Mount Thompson appears in the family records. Also recited in the court case and documented in the 1815 mortgage, Colonel John Johnson succeeded L. Nathan Haskell as owner of the 802 acres. We'd mentioned George Barsh's name previously. George Barsh on the northwest side here, the 300-acre tract granted originally to Jacob Winter. Land on the southwest and is identified as remainder part of the resurvey. In other words, land on the southwest is additional land owned by Thompson, but not part of the 1786 mortgage. I don't know the name by which Colonel John Johnson called his plantation, and I don't know how much land Johnson acquired beyond the 802 acres. Here we're looking at Mills Atlas 1825, which shows Colonel Johnston, added a T, Colonel Johnston residing near High Hill Creek, exactly the area we're talking about. This map also shows Baptist Church. This was Buckhead Baptist Church. A little larger area in this view, showing the road along which Colonel Johnston was shown in the previous slide. This is the road from Belleville to Beaver Creek. Records at the Department of Archives and History include an 1828 petition to the state legislature seeking authorization for the road commissioners of St. Matthew's Parish to maintain this road. The legislature responded in 1828 by designating much of this road as a public road. Alignment has changed for part of this road since 1827, but some of my friends and I continue to try to identify old segments of the road. Getting back to Colonel Johnson, at some time after his ownership, Frederick Cooner owned this plantation. My Congaree history colleagues and I have found very little information about Frederick Cooner. And if you happen to have great amount of information about Frederick Cooner, I would love to talk with you. 1837, I believe, is the earliest land record I've seen for Cooner. The 1850 census shows him with 103 slaves and real estate valued at $20,000. So he was obviously a very affluent gentleman. The Calhoun County Museum has a family history report titled The Rumpf and Frederick Families. According to that report, Mrs. Peter W. Frederick, whose maiden name was Anna W. Cooner, had a brother, Frederick Cooner, who was very rich, a very rich bachelor. The report says further that Frederick Cooner left the residue of his estate to Anna Cooner Frederick's children, one of whom was Alfred J. Frederick. Before we leave Frederick Cooner, I'll mention an apparent connection of Cooner's plantation with the founding of Mount Carmel Baptist Church on present-day Old Belleville Road. An article a dozen or so years ago in the Times and Democrat newspaper described that Mount Carmel's first pastor, a gentleman named Joseph Michael, was a former slave at the plantation of Captain Cooner. And in fact, in looking at deeds for land records after the Civil War, I have found some land in Joseph Michael's name that was entirely consistent with the location of Cooner's plantation. This plat shows 3,135 acres land owned in 1859 by Alfred J. Frederick. This would have been Frederick Cooner's plantation. I know the image is faint and you can't read it from where you are seated, but this is the type of plat I dream about finding. It identifies all of the tracts comprising the plantation, and tying in the first four tracts about which we talked, it identifies the John Cole tract, or John Cook tract, the Matthew Swab, Jacob Winter, and Thomas Kennerly tracts, all on the riverfront there. This plat, I'd like to give credit where credit is well deserved. This plat is a jewel, in my opinion, is a jewel in the collections of the Sally Archives. I've not seen this plat anywhere else. It is referenced and adapted in a deed that's recorded in the Orangeburg Deeds Office. But in terms of showing all the detail that's shown on here, I've not seen this this plat anywhere except the Sally Archives. This image is from Calhoun County GIS, and it shows a tract now owned by Peter Bike, 710 acres, most of which was formerly part of Frederick Cooner's plantation. Mr. Bike, in addition to this riverfront tract, owns another tract nearby, which was part of Sandy Hill Plantation, and he owns still another land, which was part of Preference Plantation. So a number of plantation names that appear in the land genealogy research. Just upriver from Mr. Bike's riverfront tract is this tract showing the present-day Sally family tract, 1,752 acres, most of which was also formerly part of Frederick Cooner's plantation. High Creek is the name by which the Sally family refers to its tract. I thought probably the Sally family was aware of the name High Hill Creek when they came up with the name High Creek for their property, but maybe they didn't. This tract, the tract granted to Thomas Kennerly in 1756 forms the northwestern part of the Sally tract. I mentioned earlier that James Kennerly, a son of Thomas Kennerly, sold the 500-acre tract to John Lord in 1776. The floodplain includes a lake, which I think you're able to see, and that lake bears the name Lord Lake. And John Lord's grave marker is also on this tract at the crest of the bluff, just a short distance from the house of Mark and Jane Sally. Okay, here we have a plat for John Lord's land. Just as William Thompson mortgaged land in 1786, John Lord also mortgaged land in 1786 to the commissioners of the paper medium loan. Some good news for John Lord when his tract was resurveyed. The new survey found 648 acres rather than the 500 acres that he thought he was purchasing. Notice again George Barsh's name. John Lord's land is bounded on the southeast by land of George Barsh, formerly the Jacob Winter 300-acre tract. And also of interest, in 1786, John Lord's tract is bounded on the northwest by General Pinckney's land. Now, General Pinckney is Charles Coatsworth Pinckney, a son of Eliza Lucas Pinckney, not to be confused with Charles Pinckney, son of Francis Bruton Pinckney, who also owned land along the Congaree River. Finding information about this plantation of Charles Coatsworth Pinckney has been a land genealogy adventure. I had determined that Henry Middleton assembled the plantation, apparently in the early 1770s, but few clues have been found about Middleton's assemblage of the plantation. Middleton purchased tracts of land which had been granted to other persons, but he didn't record the deeds. He wasn't required to record the deeds at that time. Charles Coatsworth Pinckney was a son-in-law of Henry Middleton, so it seemed likely that Pinckney acquired this plantation from Middleton, but hadn't been able to document that conveyance. Mark Kinzer is a friend in Atlanta. Mark has been writing a book about land use history of the area, which is now Congaree National Park. So he and I have collaborated on our historical research. A few years ago, Mark searched old newspapers, which are accessible online. A January 1802 newspaper announced an auction to sell several plantations. And quoting here, "In order to close the partnership concerns of Charles Coatsworth Pinckney and the late Edward Rutledge, deceased, there will be sold without reserve on Monday and Tuesday, the 15th and 16th days of February next, a plantation on both sides of Congaree River, formerly belonging to the Honorable Henry Middleton Esquire, and known by the name of the Precipice, containing by original surveys 2,910 acres of land through which the Congaree River flows, of which 1,392 acres, according to the original plats, should be swamp. Green seed cotton, hemp, and corn may be cultivated to advantage on this plantation." And that's the end of the quotation. Before Mark Kinzer discovered this 1802 auction notice, we had not known the plantation was owned jointly by Charles Coatsworth Pinckney and Edward Rutledge, rather than Pinckney alone. Rutledge was also a son-in-law of Henry Middleton, and Rutledge had died in 1800. Pinckney apparently purchased Rutledge's interest at the 1802 auction because Pinckney still owned this plantation at his death in 1825. Also, Mark Kinzer learned that the Library of Congress has papers of Charles Coatsworth Pinckney. So in 2010, Mark searched the Pinckney papers at the Library of Congress. He found a letter, which probably 1796, from Charles Drayton to Edward Rutledge. In that letter, it states that Rutledge and Pinckney had purchased this plantation from Henry Middleton in early 1783. That letter also mentions Colonel William Thompson's role in determining the value of the plantation when Middleton sold it to Pinckney and Rutledge. And the letter mentions also that William Thompson had managed this plantation when Middleton owned it. So this was all quite interesting. But still, no map had been found of this plantation of Henry Middleton or Charles Coatsworth Pinckney. One night in 2011, I noticed these nondescript records at the online index of the Department of Archives and History. The persons who indexed this map would have had no way to recognize what it depicts. No title, no date, the river is not identified, and the map does not mention Henry Middleton or Pinckney or Rutledge. The map itself is not accessible online, but the index names are accessible. I looked at the index names, I recognized the names, and I knew the location of those parcels in the upper end of Amelia and across the Congaree River. I rushed to the Archives and History Center the next day. And here's our mystery map that we looked at briefly at the start of this presentation. This is the plantation of Pinckney and Rutledge on which John Lord's tract founded in 1786. I believe this map was drawn in 1783, and definitely it was drawn before 1786. And I won't bore you with the details of how I reached that conclusion, but in any event, Charles Coatsworth Pinckney owned this plantation more than 40 years, but his ownership is virtually unknown in Calhoun County. After Pinckney died, George Butler purchased this plantation from Pinckney's daughters. Mrs. Margaret Butler, wife of George Butler, inherited the plantation when George Butler died. Joel Butler, the son of George and Margaret Butler, inherited the plantation when his mother died. Jenny Lofton Butler, the adopted daughter of Joel and Mary Ann Butler, inherited the plantation when Joel Butler died. Jenny Butler married Dr. Charles Tabor, a name that certainly recognizable in the Orangeburg area. After moving to Spartanburg, I believe this would have been after Dr. Tabor's death, but after moving to Spartanburg, Jenny Tabor received court permission in the 1890s to sell parcels of Pinckney Plantation and to reinvest the proceeds in real estate in Spartanburg. So, indeed, parcels of the plantation were sold, but in years thereafter, the Bike family gradually acquired and reassembled parcels of Pinckney Plantation. This image shows the present-day Bike's Bluff tract, now owned by Joy Bike Carpenter. This 725-acre tract is the spectacular heart of the plantation of Charles Coatsworth Pinckney, and the part of Pinckney's plantation north of the river is now part of Congaree National Park. By my analysis, the original northwestern boundary line of Amelia Township angles across the upper end of Mrs. Carpenter's tract. Perhaps you've heard of the plantation known as Gillen's Retreat, a plantation of Alexander Gillen in the 1770s and 80s and 90s. Gillen was Commodore of the South Carolina Navy during the Revolutionary War. The Bike family eventually acquired Gillen's plantation in settlement of a debt related to the Revolutionary War. We won't cover Gillen's plantation tonight, but I'll just mention that the present-day bike riverfront tracks are not Gillen land of yesteryear. Gillen's plantation was upriver, much of it between Amelia Township's upper line and Beaver Creek. How are we doing time-wise, Margaret? Keep on keeping on? Okay. Here again is Mills Atlas 1825. It shows a village by the name of Totnes. This was a village of summer residences of prominent local families. I had thought we might discuss Totnes tonight, but for now at least, let's skip over Totnes unless we have time at the end of the presentation. How this relates to the Pinckney plantation at which we were just looking. In 1827, George Butler conveyed 500 acres of his Pinckney plantation to the proprietors of Totnes Summer Seat. So that's a bit of information that can be gleaned from the deeds in the Orangeburg County Courthouse. Notice, again, before we move on, just point out, again, having been talking about Pinckney, here's a feature in the landscape identified as Pinckney Hill, close by would have been part of the Pinckney plantation and that portion of it, which became the Totnes lands. Okay, we'll sort of pick up the pace here a little bit, proceed downriver. This plat at which we've looked before for William Thompson's 1786 mortgage shows a small protrusion there on the southeast side of the tract, or northeast corner, however you want to think about it. That protrusion, I believe to have been this 54-acre tract granted to Joseph Milligan. Moving downriver, the next tract was this 200-acre tract granted to Henry Schender. Schender is among the plantation or the petitions for which Brent has published information. The petition indicates that Schender had arrived in South Carolina on a ship from Rotterdam. Isaac Huger purchased the lower half of this tract in 1771, and we'll talk in a few minutes about more about Isaac Huger. Next tract downriver was this 250-acre tract granted to Frederick Matthews, who sold the tract in 1760 to William Killingsworth. Next tract was 150 acres granted to John George Unseld, or Unsold. This plat shows Unseld's tract as riverfront. But this next image indicates or suggests that the Unseld tract might not have been riverfront. The 40-acre parcel, which is the primary focus of this slide, was surveyed in 1765 for George Thurston, but was granted instead to Timothy Dargan in 1771. And the adjoining 100-acre parcel was surveyed in 1764 for Andrew Teckel, but was granted instead to Charles Collins in 1766. The Unseld tract, the Thurston-Dargan tract, and the Teckel-Collins tract all bounded southeastward on this 200-acre tract granted to Martin Cooner. Cooner's 1749 petition mentions that he is from Switzerland. Jacob Cooner, who I presume would have or maybe I shouldn't presume, but Jacob Kuhner sold this tract in 1760 to Thomas Beamer, a planter and former Indian trader. Several of the tracts at which we have looked, part of the Schender tract, apparently part of the Matthews tract, the Dargan tract, the Collins tract, and the Martin Kuhner tract, became part of a plantation assembled by Isaac Huger. Huger's plantation also included 900 acres north of the river. Huger assembled this plantation in the early 70s. That seems to have been a time frame when a number of these plantations on the south side of the Congaree were assembled. Huger's plantation included 300 acres of land granted to Huger in 1771, but Huger assembled most of his plantation by purchasing other tracts of land. During the Revolutionary War, Isaac Huger was a general in the Continental Army. Just a few more bits of information about Huger's plantation on both sides of the Congaree. It became the site of Huger's Ferry, which was authorized by state law in 1786. Also in 1786, just we've talked about William Thompson and John Lord mortgaging land. Isaac Huger also mortgaged two tracts of land of this plantation to the commissioners of the paper medium loan. The mortgage tracts were 600 acres and 250 acres, both on the north side of the river. By 1793, I believe Isaac Huger was experiencing some financial distress, and this plantation was advertised for sale. Quite helpful for our land genealogy research. The 1793 advertisement identified the parcels comprising Huger's plantation. Of great interest, the 1793 advertisement mentions that Huger's plantation includes 167.5 acres of this 866 acre tract, which bounds northwestward on Mount Martin Kuhner's tract. This 866 acre tract was granted in 1768 to Job Marion, who was a brother of Francis Marion. Job Marion sold the entire 866 acres in 1770 to Benjamin Farrar, whose several occupations included land speculation. Real estate agent, maybe that's... Farrar apparently divided this 866 acre tract into three parts. The Isaac Huger's plantation included the western end of this tract. Miles Bruton purchased 400 acres of this tract, also from Farrar, the eastern end of the tract. And between Huger and Bruton was the plantation of Lieutenant Governor William Bull. Accordingly, Bull's plantation would have included about 300 acres in the central part of this tract. Now, some of you have had occasion to visit Congaree Bluffs Heritage Preserve. That Heritage Preserve is part, or William Bull's plantation, how do I want to say this? Present-day Congaree Bluffs Heritage Preserve was part of William Bull's plantation. An 1880s survey of the Congaree River by the Army engineers identifies land along the river as Bull's Hill and Bull's Hill Landing. Most of William Bull's plantation was north of the river. As with these plantations we've just been discussing, Bull assembled his plantation in the early 1770s, and again by purchasing other tracts of land. Unfortunately, he did not record the deeds, and we haven't found plats for this plantation of William Bull, although he owned other plantations for which we do have better land records. How we doing? Wrap it up? Okay. We'll just finish off Joe Marion's tract here. As I mentioned a moment ago, Benjamin Farrar sold 400 acres of the Joe Marion tract to Miles Bruton in July of 1772. In that same transaction with Farrar, Bruton also purchased 600 acres north of the river. Give you an idea of a view from atop the bluff of the Joe Marion tract. And the Joe Marion tract bounded downriver, northeastward, partly on this 300-acre tract, which had been granted to William Winningham. Miles Bruton purchased this tract in September 1771, at which time it was the first of the four tracts that Miles Bruton purchased along this section of the river. So that may be a good stopping point for now, and we have time for questions. Yes. Dave Schutram has assured me there will be many questions about this plan presentation, so I hope I have some answers.
Well, you know, some of those tracts, plantations went on the other side of the river, you know, what's the park. What did they do with that land? They evidently wasn't cut or anything, because the park is the way it is today. What did they do with that? What was the purpose of having that land over there?
In some cases, there was agricultural activity primarily along the riverfront. Some of it was cleared, for not all of it by any means, but some of the land north of the river, presumably some of the floodplain south of the river as well, would have been used for agricultural purposes.
And then some of the roads, you know, you showed the roads like going from Plotness and all Sandy Run all the way down towards Colonel Thompson. I guess that road, that was the main thoroughfare in its day. And I guess that's how all those plantations connected in their day. That's how they all, that was the main way of enterprise other than the river, I guess.
That would be my understanding. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But not all the roadway has been discovered yet, right?
I think, you know, we certainly don't profess to know every foot of the road, and we've found plats that identify certain segments which are identifiable in the present day landscape.
Commissioner Eliza Pinckney, was this one of the three plantations that she managed? Do you know?
No, this would have been a plantation that was property of her son, Charles Coatsworth Pinckney, and Edward Rutledge in their partnership while Rutledge was still alive. So this was not one of the plantations that Eliza Lucas Pinckney had direct management oversight.
You had indicated that this land genealogy is addictive. I'm wondering what the two-part question, what has surprised you the most about this research, perhaps other than the addictive quality? And also, what are some of your next steps? Where do you go from here?
I've got... Margaret and I were having such a conversation during supper this evening, and we recognized that with our respective efforts here, the to-do list is far, far longer than the amount of available time to possibly do it. In my case, I'm trying to complete some research reports that would document some of this. With all the plat work I've done, I have not forced myself to learn to do the deed mapper program. I do have the opportunity to be working with a gentleman in Manning who is willing to do some of that deed mapping, but even that just takes an enormous amount of time. But I mean, with the plat, I said deed mapping, the plat mapping is what I meant to say. With the all the plat studies and such, I've got notebook after notebook after notebook filled with plats in a certain sequence that makes sense to me but wouldn't necessarily be understood by anybody else. I mean, I know that this track goes next to this track, goes next to this track, goes next to this track, but that wouldn't necessarily be obvious to anybody who picked up my notebooks and proceeded to leaf through them. But I think that's the point you raise is I think we all recognize, and just as Margaret has stated, her objective to try to rediscover as much of the lost history of Orangeburg District. I think we're all striving in that same direction and trying to figure out how to capture this information and put it into some usable form.
Thank you. One more question.
Have you investigated down to the halfway swamp area along Old Number 6?
To some extent. I don't profess to have all of that sorted out, but as we indicated, always more questions than answers, and always missing pieces of the puzzle. But you know, I've had occasion to look at some of the Hallman land, for example.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate you sharing all that research with us, and I can vouch for the fact, as most of you probably know, I do very similar work all over the district. Sometimes I wish I had just a little section like he's working on, but I get an eagle's eye view of the whole district and the land. I hope you all have all had a wonderful evening. We're going to get started tomorrow morning at 8:30 with coffee and at 9 o'clock with our annual meeting, and then we'll have more interesting speakers throughout the day. So we look forward to seeing all of y'all tomorrow. Thank you.